Hello, good morning, and thanks for being here. So we have a nice panel here to talk about Europe, which I'm sure everybody's always interested in. Europe matters to us as much as the U.S. matters to us at times, even more sometimes. We have three people on the panel, two directly from Europe, actually, and Jan pretty much indirectly from Europe, and me too. We're all directly or indirectly from Europe. And we'll be talking about Europe, monetary policy, banking, and the economy, and how they are all, of course, interrelated as well. So we have Paolo Savona, who has worn a lot of hats in the past. Was at the Bank of Italy and the deposit insurance scheme of Italy, at several of the banks in Italy and the Banking Association and lots of different places. Now he's a professor emeritus at an Italian university. And Peter Pratt, who's at the ECB, the European Central Bank. He's the chief economist and he's also on the executive board. Jan Kregel, who's at the Levy Institute, he's the director of research, and he's also a professor at Tallinn University. We will talk about sort of, I guess we'll start with Peter, so we can start with European economy outlook and the monetary policy angle. And then we'll move on to Paolo, who's going to talk about sort of banking crises and Italian banks and all the different banking issues interrelated. And Jan is going to talk about Bundesbank a little bit and sort of their push and pull on this triangle of monetary policy, economy, and banks. So, Peter, if we can start with you.
Well, it's thank you for the invitation. It's not the first time. And I really enjoy your conferences. So, nonetheless, we'll see after. We'll see after this session. I have a few slides. Not sure I use them all, but as a backstop, let's keep them in mind. Three sort of comments. First, on the financial landscape. Second, about the state of the economy. And third, a little bit about monetary policy. Okay, so three parts. On the financial landscape, the euro area remains a very highly bank-intermediated environment, the first point. We should not forget it. So it's basically credit market. Securities, when you look at securities, basically government securities. If you look at other papers around, there is not so much. Corporate bonds or you take other sort of paper, equity, even equity markets are not so developed in the euro area. So that's the first remark. The second, if you look at the geographical aspect of the landscape, the financial landscape, what you see before the crisis, basically, on the asset side, you have most of the asset side is our exposures on the national economy. On the liability side, before the crisis, you have a large part, depends of countries, of course, but a large part is, a significant part is funded from other countries of the area. So this is the interbanking market. So you have a mismatch in the funding compared to the assets. Assets are basically local. Liabilities are more open and intra-European via the interbanking market. That's after the crisis now, what you see is both sides are more in balance, so assets, liabilities, but both are national, assets, liabilities. So is it good or bad for a monetary policy maker having a single monetary policy where the banking landscape is basically national? So you have a collection of national banking systems, which is an issue we may think about in terms of risk sharing, for example, across the union. So there is not much happening from the banking system. But it's better in a way than what we had before, because when the crisis came, as you know, there was a sudden stop, and the interbanking market stopped, you know, and money flew back to the current account surpluses, countries like Germany, Netherlands, a few other countries, and out of countries like Spain and Greece and other sort of countries. So you had that. So the system, in a way, is more stable. It's national-national. On the other hand, in terms of geographical diversification, that means private sector risk sharing, we have today a collection of national banking systems. So if, for example, you have a sort of a national or asymmetric shock in the system, the banking system is unavoidably exposed to that. And even if you reduce the exposure of bank on the asset side on government securities, because as you know, a lot of the asset side of banks are government securities, their own national state, it will not protect them very much if they don't have government securities, because they will be exposed to the national economy. So if the government of a country, the sovereign, has a problem, the banking system will have also a problem, even if its portfolio of government bonds has been reduced to zero, because they will be extremely exposed to the national economy. So we have a problem with, in the landscape, as I see it, as a policymaker, monetary policymaker, we have a problem because we don't have cross-border banking. So that's the first point on the landscape. The second point on the landscape since the crisis, we have done a number of good things, I mean, in terms of banking union. The first thing is, of course, we have a single supervisory mechanism, so we have supervision is single. So we have common responsibilities from the system. Me, for example, as a governing council member, the governing council as a whole, but just me as a member, we receive the decisions from the SSM board, the single supervisory mechanism board. We get decisions, but that's subject to objection, no objections from the governing council members. So that's one. So we have a responsibility in terms of supervision. That's one thing. The second is that we have what we call a single rule book. There are a lot of national discretion still around, but still, I mean, we have done a lot in terms of harmonization, in terms of regulation, but also the implementation of regulation. But there are still a number of national rules, of course. And one, of course, in terms of liquidity, the system can provide waivers, because liquidity is national. The subsidiaries will be subject to, and the branches as well, to national constraints. But there may be waivers. That means that if a subsidiary, for example, or a branch have an excess liquidity compared to what the regulation, you know, foresees, some of the excess liquidity under some conditions can be transferred to other parts of the group. There are discussions today also, can you do that for entities that have an excess of capital in the union, in some parts of the union, can you transfer this excess capital to another part of the group? Also a waiver. This is subject to discussion. I can tell you that these things are extremely controversial. And also when you have sort of a political environment which becomes more uncertain, it's also clear that the ideas of ring fencing and reducing these waivers, the volume of these waivers, reemerges very quickly, of course, in the discussion. So the banking union is a sort of odd situation because the responsibility is single. So the responsibility for cross-border banking group is the governing council, so mutualization, co-responsibility. At the same time, when things go wrong, you first have the discussion about bail-in, bail-out. So there we have a directive that deals with that, you know, the sort of pecking order, very difficult to implement because there are, of course, safeguards in terms of financial stability. We may have that discussion a little bit later today if you want. But you have safeguards for financial stability. So you have a bail-in framework now, which is, we have seen, difficult to implement, to be frank. And if things really don't work, you still have the bailout, but the bailout then will be broadly national, which creates a sort of asymmetry in the system where supervision is mutualized, and the consequences of supervisory failures will still, at the end of the day, be national. And that creates that asymmetry is something that you cannot support for a very long period of time. So there is somewhere a decision to be taken to reduce and suppress that asymmetry. You cannot do that in 1 or 2 years because you have to deal with legacies. You know, how do you deal with the legacies of the past? You have to create trust in the system. You have to develop, you know, what we call the deposit guarantee scheme at the European level. etc., etc. All these things are not done. What worries me, and I say that as a monetary policy maker, is that we don't even have a date where we have to finalize the banking union, because there's a lot of disagreement about risk reduction as a precondition for risk sharing before you can do that. And so that means that I start my reasoning by saying the landscape, a collection of national banking system, where the banking systems are exposed to the national economies. The national economies may be subject to idiosyncratic shocks that would hit the banking systems, even if they have reduced the exposure to the sovereigns, even because they will have basically the national economy as a single exposure. I say supervision is single, but the consequences are national. So this is a system which cannot last forever. What is missing today is to have a date, and I say usually 4 or 5 years as a horizon, so that banks can manage, you know, decide on their strategies if they want to expand or not expand, you know, cross-border. How can you do that if you don't know what regime you will be in the next four or five years, which is a relevant strategic horizon for a bank? It's not 10 years. It's not necessarily 1 year, but 4 or 5 years. And so I think this is something which is worrisome. So I finished my first part here. So I'm pushing personally very much for that. I think the European Commission and European Council are working on this to try to find what are the conditions to mutualize finally. But as you imagine, it's not simple, because what is still lacking today is trust. Trust in particular in the implementation of existing rules. For example, the Banking Recovery and Resolution Directive, for example. And we are in a little bit in that situation, which is not a stable situation. So I think this is a priority for very soon. Let's see what we get from a number of elections this year and next year as well, by the way. So that's my first point. The second point is on the economy. I would basically say the following. The economic recovery in the euro area is gaining momentum. So we are in a situation where we get soft data. Sentiment indicators are pretty good, and even surprise on the positive. So we tend to say on that basis, we would say the economy is gaining momentum. And there may even on that base be some upside risk on our projections for Q1 of this year and Q2 for this year. Beyond, we don't know. We don't see upside risk beyond that. But for the first and second quarter, there may be a little bit upside risk, I mean, which in terms of forecasting, that means results may be a little bit better than our projections. But that we have to see because. We have to see if the sentiment indicators fit with the hard data. You know, the debate in the US is a big gap between the sentiment indicators and the hard data. One goes, you know, it's not too good, and the sentiment indicator extremely strong. We don't have in Europe that gap between sentiment and hard data. The gap is much smaller. There is some gap between hard data and sentiment indicators, soft data, but the gap is not as in the US. That's good news. The second thing also that we have seen, we checked that our research people, our economists, is to look if the relationship between sentiment indicators and hard data is stable or not over time. So we run different sort of regressions, different periods of time. What we see basically, if you take a PMI sort of indicator, that sort of indicator, the relation seems to be, as before, relatively robust. So we basically say that the hard data are very likely to confirm the sentiment indicators. But of course, they're very coincident and very short term. It's Q1, Q2. You won't go beyond that. But that's positive. That's why I say there may be some upside risk in the very short term. If you look longer term, I can only repeat a little bit medium to longer term, we would still say that risks are still tilted to the downside, although we say that the risks are much more balanced. That was the last Governing Council communication, that risks are more balanced, but are still tilted to the downside. As I say, for the very short term, Q1, Q2, there may be some upside risk, but looking beyond, there are still downside risks prevailing. Now, the Governing Council meets next week, plus one day, so we are not yet in the quiet period. Jan, very well done. And we will meet and we will reassess the balance of risk, as you know. So here I will not prejudge what will be the decision of next week. That's that's one part of the data. The second is sort of disconnect between hard and soft data. I say it's lesser than in the US, so more confident on this. The second aspect is when you look at confidence indicator, the soft data, and all the indicators of political uncertainty. You know that debate too? We see high political uncertainty and high confidence. Consumer, business, construction, a little bit across the board now. So why this disconnect? Still a mystery now. You may conclude that the voters are upset about the political system, but at the same time, they're relatively optimistic on the economy. So there's a maybe they think, you know, they want to express some protest vote, but at the end of the day, they think, yeah, that's no crazy things will be done and that policy will be reasonable at the end. What reasonable means remains to be seen, but some confident that, you know, there will not be a big shakeup, you know, in the economic environment linked to politics. I don't know. We will see later on how things will unfold. But we have this sort of very strange picture where high confidence, and at the same time, you have high percentages of sort of protest votes, you know, and alternative sort of parties that you see at the same time. So it's something that we will know a little bit later what comes out of this, but it's something we observe now that confidence is high, although in political terms, uncertainty is high as well. So what is the reason behind? Now, when you look at the GDP, we have more confidence in our projection. So we think, yes, indeed, it's resilient. We had a number of shocks. The last big one was a little bit more than a year ago, the emerging market shock, which was a real shock. I mean, I really understand why there was a pause of the Federal Reserve in terms of interest rate. I mean, Eric, you may discuss, but I thought it makes sense to say that shock, you know, after the G20 meeting in Shanghai was to say, well, let's see a little bit how this shock will be absorbed, what will be the policy reaction. And you remember the G20 had a very clear communication to use all the instruments available to try to support the world economy in general. And we did with monetary policy. I interpret the US pause in the tightening cycle. I think broadly what we have seen is okay. The economy, the world economy is doing better, is recovering. There's sort of cyclical recovery at the world level. But it's true, looking beyond the short term, there are still a number of worries on the world economy, as you know, of course. And so that remains, and these will be the discussions in the coming days in the IMF. So when we go back to Europe, what you see is that, indeed, the economy has been firming. We say it's broad-based, we also say. When we say broad-based, we see that it's across countries, so all countries are growing. You see also that it's broad-based across sectors. Usually you had construction doing a number of countries very badly, but the construction sector is recovering everywhere. There may be one or two exceptions, but from what I see, it's basically in a recovery phase in most of the countries. That's for construction. And but basically it's domestic demand driven. It's not export. If you look before, all the recoveries we had in Europe in the last more than 10 years, before the crisis also, there was a lot which was internationally driven. Now we have a domestic-based recovery, which we explain largely to a very accommodative monetary policy. It's not only oil prices which fell, which is one part of the impulse that was given to consumption, but also unit profits of firms. But also because of very easy financial conditions, which stimulated the economy, and in particular, the construction sector now. But you see, and construction, of course, led to spending in durables and non-durables goods related to construction very often. So consumption is very well supported by disposable income. But what is also very interesting is when you look at disposable income of households, you see that wages have been very moderate, and from our perspective in terms of inflation, maybe a little bit too moderate. And we are always surprised that wages are not slightly strong, especially in a country like Germany, for example. But on the other, that's a little bit the worrisome part of the picture. But the other part of the picture, which is positive, it has been very, very much, it surprised on the positive side in terms of employment. So employment is much stronger than what we had predicted. Wages weaker and employment strong. So disposable income has been very well supported. and in real terms even more because of oil prices, terms of trade gains, which are being reduced because oil prices went up again. But basically, you had a real disposable income was quite strong because the basis of disposable income was more employment than wages. The propensity to consume from income coming from employment is higher than coming from wages. And so the propensity to consume has been strong. And if you look at the savings rate has been rather stable. Now with the increase of oil prices, the recent increase of oil prices, you have seen that consumption has not been reduced. And the savings rate has been reduced a little bit. Now there's a lot of discussion in Europe about the impact of negative rates on savings, saying, negative rates, people will save more because they have to make up the lost income, for their pension, You don't see that. Savings rate has been stable or even going down slightly. So we don't see a perverse effect on domestic demand via savings related to the negative rates that we have put in place. We don't see that. So that's positive. Even the latest figures indicate that the savings rate has fallen at the euro level as a whole. In Germany, it's true the savings ratio of households has increased, but very slightly. You wouldn't put that in relation to the negative rates. It's impossible to tell today, and it's very small anyway. So that's for consumption, it's based. When we talk about it's very rich in terms of employment, it's also due to reforms in the labor market. We also see that very clearly in some countries, including Italy, for example, but even more for a country like Spain, for example. So there's a lot of evidence that these structural reforms on the labor market work in terms of employment. Where they have a problem, of course, is in terms of duality on the labor market, because very often these reforms have protected the incumbent and increased the flexibility for the unemployed coming back on the labor market. So that's one of the issues which can explain also the protest votes and why among the voters you find in some countries, in France, for example, that the younger generation tend to support extremist parties, for example. From the right, for example. So that's one of the things that, but that's not a central banker sort of preoccupation. It's not in our mandate. If you look at investment has been weak, recovering now nicely in construction, but business investment is weak, as you see that also in the United States. But we start to see positive sign also in relation to the recovery of international trade. Where you see that the export of capital goods from Europe, Germany in particular, has been picking up. But also on the domestic market, you see the demand for capital goods has been in very recent data improving. So it's still relatively weak in historical standards, but it's recovering as well. Now, if you look at policy stance, fiscal policy has been and remains broadly neutral. You remember there were periods in 2011, of very strong consolidation, fiscal policy consolidation. We may discuss about this. And monetary policy has been extremely accommodative. And I will comment a little bit on that, and then I will conclude. If you look at the role, and this is a key issue when you look forward in terms of policy making, monetary policy making, the picture I describe now, which is a recovery which is gaining momentum, which is resilient. We had a number of shocks, and still we are on the same path. And we are more confident on that profile. The question, of course, which will occupy us in the coming periods is to what extent is that path explained by very accommodative monetary policy, or by very, very easy financial conditions, which also depends on the international context, for example, the spillovers, for example, of US policies or US financial conditions on our financial conditions. So to what extent is the path I was describing self-sustained, or to what extent is it depending on very easy financial conditions for which monetary policy plays a key role? That's the key question for the Governing Council in the coming periods. And to what extent, when the day will come that you have to turn your monetary policy stance to go the other way, which in any way you would have, in any case, you would have to do in a very cautious and orderly way, because we have a very expansionary monetary policy since more than 5 years now. 11 was the last tightening in Europe, 11. And so after more than 5 years now of very easy monetary conditions, when you the day you decide to turn, you have to be careful, of course, because it follows a very long period of that. The time has not come according to the Governing Council, but that's the discussion to see to what extent the recovery that we have now is self-sustained, and when you will start, when time comes, this monetary accommodation, you have to be sure that the economy is self-sustained, has reached a sort of escape velocity that will insulate it from changing monetary policy conditions. And that's, the Governing Council has concluded the last meeting, it's not yet the time to conclude in that direction. So we will see in the coming period. But that's the key debate for the coming periods. Now, if I go to inflation, and that's our mandate, as I say, my contract as ECB mayor is very clear, it's price stability in the medium term, and we defined it, as you know, in a certain way. And it's true that when you look at this, on the positive side, the deflation fears are gone. So I will show you very quickly a few slides to illustrate what I said. But the deflation fears are gone, so that's positive. You say that's not so obvious in recent times. The second thing on the negative side is that underlying price pressures remain very weak, subdued, we say. We don't see really convincing signs of upside pressures on inflation, underlying inflation. You don't see that yet. In our projections, in our models, yes, we see that. We project indeed that underlying inflation is going up, and going up by 2019 close to 2% in 2019 or somewhere at that horizon. The problem, of course, is that this still requires a very accommodative monetary policy, and to what extent? That's the debate I mentioned before. And second, of course, is that there are some downside risks related to that projection, because when you run one of the factors explaining that path is wages, nominal wages. And nominal wages have surprised, as I said before, on the down. And this may be related to the fact when you run Phillips curve, thousands of Phillips curves, you would see that these Phillips curve, there is some improvement in the Phillips curve when you have a broader definition of slack on the employment market. So when you take involuntary part-timers, you know, and people having retired from the, dropped out of the labor market, you know, as in the US, you also have these sort of indicators. And these indicators tend to explain recently better the evolution of wages than the official unemployment rate per se. So the amount of slack may be bigger than what the unemployment figure would show, would indicate. So that there is some downside on that. But on the other hand, as I say, the economy is more broad-based, and there are some positive factors on the other side. Now, let's say on monetary policy now, and then I will conclude looking through very quickly some of the slides that summarize my points. As I say, in terms of flows, things go better. Now the question, especially in this environment, on this conference, we had a balance sheet recession, excess debt in a number of countries. And so what about the stock adjustment? What about legacies and all that? How far are you? There, I think on the household side, we are very well advanced in the correction, especially in a country like Spain, for example, for NFCs as well, non-financial corporations. So I think the stock adjustment is well advanced. We are not so sure. We are looking at that very much. We think broadly it's done. There may be pockets still of legacies in some countries, indeed, that you can see in the levels of non-performing loans, for example, which indicate that the balance sheet, the stock adjustment, is not yet fully realized. But broadly for the union, you would say it's broadly done, but there are still important pockets there which are not yet done, which are being addressed. Maybe we hear from our colleague from Italy. So that's one thing. So there we have a lot of progress. The question of heterogeneity across countries also has been, I think, improved very much also. We had, compared to what it was in 2012, for example, 13. So in terms of banking also, I think the recapitalization of banks also, as I say, there are a number of weaknesses still in the system, but I think broadly speaking, a lot of adjustment has been done yet. The problems we have in the banking, as you know, in Europe, is basically the problems of profitability, banking models, and the fact that the sector actually in the crisis has not consolidated very much. in the crisis. And so that's one of the aspects of the low profitability. From our point of view as a policy, monetary policy maker, the competition you have in markets where the credit demand is still very weak, which is normal after a debt crisis, but the competition you have in the banking system, which results from sort of overbanking, overcapacity in some of the countries, in the short term is not bad for us because banks tend to transmit easy conditions to their customers. And we see that very clearly in the banking lending service. We published one, one very soon. I think it's in the coming very soon. Michael knows the date. I read them already. But you see in general in this service that things go in the right direction because of competition. Now, in the longer term, it's not necessarily good, of course, because the profit margins are weak in the banking system. And then the further recapitalization of the banking system, of course, is more difficult because you don't make a sufficient profit. And the debate has been very much on the impact of negative rates on the profitability of banks. And some have even suggested, that in our forward guidance, we have to invert the guidance and first increase the rates, before we stop, making purchases of securities, including government bonds. We should not forget, first for the banking sector, that it's not only the unit margin that will count. And it's true that the unit margin are under pressure. If you fund via deposits and you have stickiness, it's zero because you cannot implement negative rates, which remains to be seen because some banks do that indeed. But there is some stickiness, on the liability side on deposits. But the impact on the economy of the negative rates all over for us remains extremely positive. Our experience with the negative rates reducing the constraint we have on the zero lower bound, and then we have tested below that. We have brought the whole yield curve to very low level. You remember the 2013 tapering discussions in the US. At that time, we started to lower the rates and we tested the zero lower bound and we went to negative in the months after 2013. And that's the time where also we decoupled very much our monetary policy from the US monetary policy. It's very easy to look at the yield curves between the US and Europe. And that's where you had very easy financial conditions in Europe. Where we were isolated from the spillovers of the tantrum in the US country to the emerging markets. It's very incredible when you see the curves of forward guidance together with testing the zero lower bound, so going below the zero lower bound, have allowed us to decouple the monetary policy from the spillover. The IMF is coming very much with the argument about spillovers, the impact of especially US monetary policy on financial conditions in other countries. What we see, yes, there are influences from the US, but also we have the tools to isolate our monetary policy from the US. Of course, everything is interdependent, but also there are ways for us to isolate from the US if needed, of course, depending. And so we had a good experience. So we see the banks, of course, have to be patient, but basically they have to deal with their cost structure, which remains very high. So it's easier to criticize the negative rates than to deal with the problem of overcapacity and business models, which are not, from an economic point of view, the best ones. And I think these problems have to be dealt, by the banks. I think the banking sector has understood that. It's very recent. And I think in a number of countries, the most critical countries in terms of monetary policy, you see that also happening. Now, of course, they would prefer the rates to go up. But as I said at the conference in Frankfurt with Mario Draghi the other week, we have to realize that the negative rate, what we call the deposit facility rate, which is the rate where banks have excess reserves related to our QE, they place that with the central bank, they get minus 40 basis points. That's the monetary policy rate. So if you touch that rate, you change the stance of monetary policy. The whole yield curve would be influenced by that. And so I will, if there are questions, I can go into that. But that deserves a long discussion. So our forward guidance has been reaffirmed by the last governing council and reaffirmed, when was it, last week, in a conference in Frankfurt, ECB and its watchers, by Draghi and me, by the way. So that's on monetary policy. Now to conclude, and then look a little bit about the slides I've prepared. Why are we in all this situation? I mean, it's 10 years, We are in 2017. It started in 2007, at the middle of 2007. That was the trigger of the turning point of the credit cycles. It's a Minsky sort of discussion now that we can have. So where is it's very difficult to explain. So what I show you very very rapidly to illustrate a little bit how I see it personally. It may be wrong, but that's the way I see it. Here you see the real GDP growth expectations. Very simple. Growth expectation, I think it's six years ahead, if I remember. It's not written on the slide.
6 to 10 years ahead.
It's 6 to 10 years, thanks. It's 6 to 10 years ahead, your growth expectation. Oh, I have it here. So it's 6 to 10 years ahead, growth expectations. So in 2003, people thought, forecasters thought, growth would be the next 6 to 10 years, 225%. Now they see it 125% the next six. There's a lot of difference. Because if you plan your investment, you buy a house or whatever, on the basis of your expected income, you go from 225 to 125 at the end of the period. It makes a huge difference in terms of debt sustainability, of course. That's one thing you see. The second thing you see is also in the crisis. You see 2007, 2008, these expectations are revised very much downside. So the first part may be related to the productivity slowdown, which was not well assessed by our societies, so the sort of productivity slowdown, you know, that TFP sort of issue. The second one is more hysteresis, probably, stories. It's the way you manage the bust of the credit cycle. And we had big problems in Europe because, as well as the national level, as the European level, we didn't have very good institutions to deal with banking crisis. And we had no institution to deal with sovereign debt crisis, by the way. So we had a double problem of weak institutions dealing with crisis, very soon. Not only at the European level, I mean, all of you know that, and we try to put that in place now. I said that at the beginning, the introductory part. But the second thing also is, also at the national level, you didn't have good institutions to deal with that. And so you had a lot of too big to fail and a lot of bailouts and all that. And So there, the way the crisis was managed, so not very well, because of a lack of good institutions, probably created a number of issues like hysteresis. We call hysteresis effect that further pushed down the potential growth rate. I mean, this sort of Blanchard and others, Summers and Blanchard sort of argument. So it matters the way you manage, demand shocks, in the economy. Because they create sort of permanent consequences on growth rates. There you see, the dotted red would be the historical pattern of growth. The yellow would be the actual GDP. You see the double dip, the 2009 and the 2011-12, dip, which is related to the banking sovereign, doom loop, remember that? And then the blue is the potential growth. And of course, we may... And that's what we see. You close the output gap, in the next, 2 years, something like 2-3 years. You close the output gap in the next 2-3 years. But it's not necessarily a satisfactory level of GDP per capita, of course, because your potential has fallen already before the crisis, but has been accelerated during the crisis. So that's one of the... Now, of course, you do the same per country. That's even worse. You see the heterogeneity across countries. These are very well-known graphs. This is your area as a whole. Same graph as before. This is Spain recovering very strongly. This is Italy, and Germany is the blue one. And there you see on the right you see the bank loans to the private sector. You see a very nice sort of Minsky sort of graph, a financial cycle where you see the credit expansion in Spain, for example, 25% year on year. And for your area, you see 10% year on year. Obviously, there were a number of warning signals given by the ECB at that time, because I checked, in all the communication at that time. But obviously, we didn't have the macroprudential tools or other tools to deal with that. And the banks were not sufficiently well capitalized to do that. I will distribute the graphs. That's a graph, for example, showing the dispersion of interest rates across countries on public debt. You know that. So when we talk about financial repressions because the rates are very low or even negative, we also have to see that in that monetary union, some of the countries had in the crisis period, because for good or bad reasons, whatever the reasons, But the countries had, at some points, extremely tight financial conditions, of course, which we had to deal with. And when you look at the peak there, it peaks, you know, in July 12 when Mario came with the whatever it takes, and then the spreads went down and the financial conditions start to ease, et cetera, et cetera. And this is the graph where you have the budget balance. That's the flow part, and that's the stock part. So you see, for example, that during the crisis, 2008-2009, there was a very big expansion of deficit to support the economy. That was a time when Spain, which was AAA economy, spent 4% of GDP. I think it was 40 billion for a 1 trillion economy. So it's 4% of GDP in discretionary support for the economy. That was a AAA at that point. And then you have, in relation with the sovereign debt crisis, the what we call now the austerity part, which is very controversial, so I will not discuss that here. It's lack of time also, I'm happy to do that. But you have this big contraction in 11. And then is it kaputt sparen? You know, as they say in Germany, you contract the demand, so it's counterproductive. You know, that's the thing which is still debated today. And then you have the situation today. I mean, that's the inflation, price of production against deflation and inflation. The yellow is price of production against deflation. You see all these spikes, you know, in the markets, and usually you see it's not too badly correlated with some ECB action when you see these graphs. So sometimes you see this, the fears about inflation or deflation are balanced in the economy. So people, markets do not know. So it's inflation or deflation. There's a lot of uncertainty about, you know, what will be the policy response and the impact on inflation on prices. But you see, over time, it's deflation fears start to dominate, and you see in recent period it was really the price of protection of deflation against deflation where it dominated, and nobody wanted to pay any price to be protected against inflation. That's what it means. These are the instruments we took. There are some graphs if you want to look explaining the CDS of sovereigns and CDS of banks. I'm almost finished now. CDS of banks, and you see a very good correlation between the CDS of sovereigns and CDS of banks. You can also link that very well with action of the ECB to bring back these points back to the left, down, for different measures. I take Italy and Spain because they are the most spectacular one. That's what I explained about decoupling monetary policy from the US. That's the balance sheet of US. We decided to our purchase program. We had a discussion in the spring of 14, also here in Washington. The reason was that we saw that the economy was losing momentum again in the spring of 14, and that's why we decided really to have a very expansionary monetary policy, because in the previous periods, you had the first period was really you provide liquidity to the banks to avoid fire sales of assets. That's the classical thing in a crisis. You give the banks time, you know, to manage the problem. The second was very, very difficult, which was the fear of breakup of the euro, which culminated with the whatever it takes, and also the promise of government, the decision of governments, head of states, to create a banking union, which also an institution being able to deal with sovereign debt crisis, the ESM. And then the third big part in monetary policy was really when we started to address the domestic demand problem, which is when we decided to broaden our purchases to government bonds. And you know a little bit about that discussion. And that's about it. That's the inflation, and that's the institutional changes which I mentioned. Supervision, recovery and resolution, that's the BRRD, the framework for resolution, and the SRM, the single resolution mechanism, the body dealing with resolution of banks, which are new institutions. And that's it. So in a nutshell, things have improved. I think the stock adjustment is well advanced, but not finished. In monetary policy terms, it's very important to finalize this banking union and to have cross-border banking institutions, not to have only cross-border institutions, but to have a diverse landscape. We also have cross-border institutions in terms of private sector risk diversification. And the last one on monetary policy, as I said before, that will be the discussion for the coming periods, will be to what extent is this recovery that we observe self-sustained, even if we at a point where you withdraw accommodation is the economy sufficiently robust to continue on that path I described before? So that's the story. Thank you.
Thank you. I experienced three monetary and banking crises in Italy from 1970 to 2014, when I ended my position as chairman of the deposit guarantee scheme in Italy. I am not analyzing the crisis from the point of view of the theory, but comparing my experience with some ideas of Minsky, in particular the 2 months, two masters, Minsky masters, which considered the money as a way to help the financial stability and a way to give credit to investors. During the first crisis, Jan Kregel was a relevant member of the group of people studying this problem, which arised from the oil crisis of the 70s. And Chaim Minsky was a consultant. We tried to understand what was happening, and Jan advanced a new explanation of the so-called Italian miracle based on the variable, the terms of trade as a relevant variable of the Italian miracle, and the oil crisis discharged the terms of trade and was the turning point of the Italian economy, Italian development. What is the history of the Italian banking system? In 1936, banking law was introduced in response of the 29-33 Great Depression for industry and the banks. A large part of industry went under the control of the state, and the banking system was largely nationalized. The law was based on the specialization of banks' activity according to the maturity of liabilities and assets. It was under the control of the Treasury Minister, but the supervision was entrusted to the Bank of Italy. In 1993, the government, chaired by the former Governor Ciampi and IES Minister of Industry, obtained by the Parliament a new banking law. The specialization approach was abandoned in favor of the universal approach. The hope was to serve the second Minsky master, the availability of credit for capital investment. This was the approach, the idea. The first Minsky master, to protect savers, the stability of the payment system, was introduced, creating a voluntary bank deposit guarantee scheme, different from the solution of the FDIC in the United States, which is an insurance company. In Italy, it's a sort of mutual assistance among banks. In 1992, Italy signed the Maastricht Treaty. The Italian Parliament ratified the agreement with a very modest discussion on its consequences. In a pamphlet, I define this choice as a Europe on clay foundations. I fought the decision to enter the euro system immediately. Instead, I suggested the utilization of the opting out clause of the treaty used by the UK. Now we understood why it was too early to enter in the euro. Until May 1998, when the European Community decided to accept Italy in the euro system, the Italian government pursued the objective to enter the euro system. Any instrument was monetary and fiscal, was used to abide by the obligation to stabilize the exchange rate of the lira and re-enter in a budget deficit of 3%. Both parameters had been agreed in an addendum on the Maastricht Treaty. The most relevant decision taken were to invest a large part of the official reserves in order to peg, mainly in 1992, so after the sign of the Maastricht Treaty, immediately, to peg the lira exchange rate, and my government and friend Carlo Azeglio Ciampi spent 30 billions of lira, of dollars of official reserves, practically all the official reserves. Cut public investment, they cut to reduce public expenditure and introduce a euro tax of 3%. So immediately tax. Obviously, the impact of the decision to join the euro is that no masters, no Minsky masters, have been served. We cannot say if our low growth and high unemployment is due to either domestic weakness or to European decisions. So there is a dispute. You know, it is impossible from the point of view of economic theory to analyze exactly. So it's a matter of opinion. But we know that both are in action. So domestic weakness and European decision. Without the possibility to escape using traditional instruments of economic policy adjustment. In the past, Italy used money creation, interest rates, fiscal intervention, and devaluation of the lira, and these instruments are now lost without having any equivalent tools in the European Union. So you gave sovereignty, and we had back the not the same strong instruments. The unbearableness of the situation emerged after the Great Recession of 2008. Recent monetary policy helped us. This is true, what Peter Pratt said. But the European fiscal policy constraints have been reinforced. So we have a better money, but we have a worse fiscal policy. Was reinforced with the 2002 so-called fiscal compact agreement to push public budgets to equilibria. And this principle entered in the Italian constitution according to the European agreement. The European Union approach to the crisis is to make reforms mainly in the labor market, one of the points that Pratt advanced. I add, and also in the welfare system. But they produce deflation, at least in the short run, making difficult to adjustment of the public budget disequilibria and the economic recovery. So things have been complicated. The impact on the Italian banks and the European Banking Union. At the beginning of the crisis, the management of the Italian banks was traditional. It was said that they did not speak English to stress that they were not involved with financial innovations, deluding authorities and the bankers on their capacity to absorb the shocks. So after the crisis 2008, the authorities and the banks, I was there, were convinced that they were in condition to face the crisis. Also because the government insisted that a rapid recovery of the economy was around the corner. You can see that every 6 months, the government was saying, next the quarter, we will have the increase. This was a sort of message confirming the idea that the banking crisis, the Italian banking sector, was in condition to react to the crisis. These are the two mistakes. The delay in recovery and public interventions increased non-performing loans, as you know. The crisis in Italian banks was made more difficult by the promulgation of the European Union directive, promptly and wrongly ratified by the Italian Parliament, prohibiting public intervention to save banks that had already been made promptly by other European member countries. It was also decided to create a European Banking Union, transferring the supervision of big banks to a new European Union authority, and the common law on deposit guarantee schemes and the resolution of a banking crisis under the ECB surveillance. I was, as chairman of the Italian deposit guarantee scheme, strongly against, and then ended my experience in the public sector. The national sovereignty went to Brussels, and the two masters are not served. This is the condition. This is the conclusion of my very rapid analysis. The joint result is that Italy lost the possibility to serve either one of the two masters, money and the financial stability, and the credit availability to real investments. So the amount of credit given to the system was reduced after the crisis. But obviously, it's a rational reaction of the banks because the economy is not growing, and so the banks cannot increase credit, creating risks. The will of the Italian elites to stay in the European Union is that at any cost, we have to stay in Europe. This is the position of the elites, the majority of the elites. Even if we pay with a low growth and high unemployment, any tentative to discuss on this argument at political level or at the academic level is practically without any result. If we want assistance, Europe is in condition to give us. We should accept, anyhow, to lose the residual fiscal sovereignty as Greece, accepting the control of the so-called triad. Is the right pronunciation, triad? Okay, thank you. ECB, Commission, and IMF. Despite this situation, we show ability to survive. Industrial exports are growing, and the foreign current account is in surplus. So there is not a problem of productivity, a problem of terms of trade for Italy. Why to insist on productivity and to ask to intervene on the labor market? I disagree completely. There is no... It is impossible to use the same tool of analysis for different countries, the so-called one size does not fit to all. The European Union is insisting on labor market and the welfare reforms to increase productivity, as we hear before, but the people refuse to accept them. Social problem overwhelm economic condition. So we have to decide if we accept democracy or if we decide to give our residual sovereignty to the rest of the world, as Greece. With the difference that Greece voted to stay in the euro, instead the Italian constitutions refused to accept referendums on foreign agreements. This is a legal problem in Italy. What are my conclusions? The Italian banking crisis is not the direct result of a 2008 world financial crisis. Its transmission to the real economy was due to mistaken choices of a political economy, deflationary taxation, a cut in employment and salaries, and the wrong forecast on the time for recovery, as I said at the beginning. Non-performing loans increased and the banks reacted procyclically, rationing credit. The European decision accepted too quickly, I insist, by the Italian Parliament to create a banking union, a new deposit guarantee scheme, a new resolution mechanism, weakened the confidence on the Italian banking system. The waiver of monetary sovereignty prevents Italy from using the traditional instrument of adjustment without having a better policy by the European Union, which is written in the Italian Constitution. So we are respecting one aspect but not the other, because it's written that you can give your sovereignty if you are guaranteed that the rest of the world participating, like in Europe, give the same, and if the result is better than to use directly the sovereignty. This is written in the Constitution after the fascist drop in 1946. Italy is now bound in an institutional straitjacket, facing an impossible choice between staying in the European system, hoping for a better future, or accepting to go backward. Banks are approaching the system, reducing credit and gaining from the payment system. So at present, the Italian bank system is a rent sector, giving through commission on the payment system without the possibility to guarantee the reimburse of this deposit. Because with the new European directive, the Italian guarantee scheme can reach an amount of 80% of the guaranteed deposits, which are now near to 800 billion euro. So they have only 1% of the possibility to intervene. And my task when I was, instead of discussing with my friends at the Bank of Italy, I was sending a graph where there is the level of intervention according to the condition of the bank's budget. For an intervention of 10 billion euro, you induce 15 banks to fail. If you intervene with 20 billion, we induce 30 banks to fail. So you have an instrument which is in condition to create a systemic crisis. The problem is that once again, we have no reply from this clear objection how the European economic system or the euro system is working. I still believe that the possibility of, to react of Italy is very high. But Italy, generally speaking, react to big shocks. So continuing this kind of a policy, we can avoid big shocks, but we cannot avoid the downgrading of the Italian welfare. Thank you.
Okay, I'm going to try and present to you a solution partially to the problem that Paolo proposed, a solution for a number of periphery countries. And I will start out by saying that, in fact, none of these arguments are my own. And in fact, the title should not have been the German argument, but it should have been the Bundesbank's argument for a two-speed solution to the euro political crisis. What I'm going to try to do is present to you the logic behind the way German monetary policymakers, and particularly the German Central Bank, viewed the creation of the euro and the way they would view resolving what is now basically a political crisis, I would argue, more than an economic crisis. I think, as Paolo suggested, the problem is this mismatch between the ability to deal with social problems and the ability to introduce the mechanisms that are required for the survival of the euro. And the question is, eventually, you have to make a choice between the two. He suggested that eventually it's going to be the democratic process which decides to do this. The Bundesbankers have a very simple solution. And that simple solution is a two-speed Europe. and I'm going to try to explain to you how they arrive at that particular solution. Okay, if we start out with the Maastricht Treaty, basically, from the point of view of German economists, and in particular those who were in the Bundesbank, and particularly those on the council, and I think, as I've mentioned previously, in a previous life, I spent a great deal of time in Italy and was attached to the Johns Hopkins Bologna Center. German bankers like Italy a lot, and so it was quite easy to invite the Bundesbank Council members to conferences in Bologna because the food is very good, the weather is very good, the city is very nice. So I got to know these people reasonably well because, as I say, they were very pleased to accept invitations to come and speak to our students. And the representations that I'm going to use primarily come from Otmar Issing. And they're particularly interesting because he was a governing council member at the Bundesbank at this period and eventually became the chief economist of the ECB and was crucial in outlining monetary policy for the ECB. Simple terms, the response that the German economists made to the Maastricht Treaty was what they called the sin of variable velocity. Variable velocity how? Well, without going into a great deal of history of the development of the EEC into the European Union via the single internal market or the single European Act. Basically, the idea was that because the initiative to political integration was stalling, that it was necessary to come up with some mechanism to rekindle interest in the project of a unified Europe. And that project was in the Maastricht Treaty in terms of specifying a single internal market, and eventually that the single internal market required a single currency or a common currency. Now, the response of the Germans to this was, well, if we look, the Maastricht Treaty provides for us a timetable, it provides a map, it provides conditions on monetary unification, but it provides no timetable, no conditions, or any idea of when political unification would in fact occur. And I now quote from Issing's, the vast majority of German economists advocated the so-called economist view that monetary union should be the final step in a long process of European integration. Just the opposite of what was proposed in the Maastricht Treaty. But in 1999, 11 heterogeneous countries embarked on a highly ambitious act towards economic and monetary union, despite concerns that the euro might fail. As an economist, I shared the German view, which was that basic economic and political integration should precede the introduction of the single currency. It was often at that time called the crown, which would be imposed on the successful project of European unification. If we look at monetary sovereignty, the statement, again, this is a statement that comes from a German Bundesbanker. This one comes from Hans Tietmeyer, the chairman of the council. Historical experience shows that national territories and monetary territories coincide. The relevant legislation, as a rule, the relevant legislation, as a rule, defined monetary sovereignty in relation to a national territory. That is, those of you who are familiar with some currency literature, and in particular German currency literature, the expression of the nation is in its currency. The Deutschmark was the expression of Germany. In contrast to the normal rule, the Maastricht Treaty implies a clear discrepancy between the intentionally rather modest political integration and monetary integration. After a certain point, economic integration cannot realistically be expected to advance further without the prospect of further progress in the field of politics. Okay, we have now reached a point, says Mr. Tietmeyer, at the transfer of an elementary sovereign right, such as monetary policy, to a European central bank is likely to mark that point. Tietmeyer is saying, okay, we've gone far enough with this transfer of monetary sovereignty. Now we have to create that political union in order to allow the correspondence between the single currency and the single political union. Now, let's look very quickly at why there was such stress on this idea of political integration and having a federal, if you like, political structure. And this, again, comes from literature that was produced by members of the Bundesbank. In particular, this is a pamphlet that Otmar produced at this time, explaining why it was necessary to stop the process of monetary integration and to proceed with increased political integration. With a common currency, negative external shocks have to be met with increased downward wage flexibility and labor market conditions, since devaluation is no longer a policy option. Political unification must support redesigned, hardened labor market adjustment, not harmonization of social safety nets at highest common denominator. Okay? If you're a straightforward economist and you take away the right to use devaluation as a mechanism of adjustment, what are you left with? You're left with internal adjustment, what we today call austerity. Everybody says austerity is awful. The Bundesbankers are telling you, look, you made a choice. You decided to join the common currency. You gave up devaluation. You accepted that you had to impose austerity. Now, the common currency also reduces government's incentives to prudent fiscal policy. Because, number one, there is no exchange rate risk. Okay, what concentrates a government better than an exchange rate crisis? Common currency, you don't have them anymore. Also, what concentrates attention of the government better than having a very large impact on your domestic financial market and on interest rates? The so-called bond mark vigilantes, which we know in the United States. If you have a single common currency and a common interest rate, the bond mark vigilantes disappear. We're all familiar with the famous chart of risk-adjusted interest rates in the European Union after the introduction of the euro, which Italy, a country which had a debt-to-GDP ratio in excess of 120%, or Greece, which had one which we didn't know about, which was greater than that, had virtually the same risk-adjusted interest rates as you found in Germany. Finally, national differences in unemployment and commitment to fiscal prudence will produce political pressure for compensation from the wealthier or less indebted to the poorer or more indebted areas. Okay? If you have, you know, conditions or political weakness that doesn't allow you to introduce these adjustments, and you have political backlash, if you have pushback, what's going to happen? Well, the Germans said the Italians are going to come to us and ask for help. In fact, it didn't turn out to be the Italians, it turned out to be the Greeks. But basically the concern was that if you did not have a strong political union, the national governments who were unable to impose the required austerity in order to meet the conditions of the euro would then ask the more successful members for transfers. And we all know the German political discussion in which the German taxpayer is no more willing to pay for what they believe to be the profligate behavior of the Greeks and Italians and the other southern Europeans than the U.S. taxpayer is to do so for U.S. bankers. This undermines political solidarity and support for the common monetary policy. It may even undermine the ability of the ECB to establish the price stability that is the prerequisite for the euro to be established as a credible alternative to national currencies. Now, I've just gone through the sort of the major arguments. There are a number of other less important arguments that are put forward, but you can sort of see the idea behind this, the requirement of a strong political system. It has to be there in order to enforce this kind of wage adjustment, social safety net adjustment, and the reduction and the resistance to the pressures that will come from the weaker countries in order to either ask for transfers or to ask for suspensions of some of the rules. Now, we all know about the various requirements that have been appended now to the conditions either for joining the euro or maintaining into the euro. Okay? Why are they there? They're there precisely because, as the Germans recognized, the strong political unification would not be present, therefore these particular requirements were necessary as a substitute for political requirements. We have the Stability and Growth Pact, the Six Pack, the Two Pack, you name it. I mean, every 2 or 3 years, we come up with another set of conditions which basically impose on the members what the political unification was supposed to provide. Now, let's compare this assessment with the experience of Germany after the introduction of the euro. We know that there was a very, very strong policy of deficit reduction, particularly in response to the deficits that were generated by German reunification, strong reductions in the social welfare system, introduced not by a right-wing government, but by a left-wing government, introduced flexibility in labor markets, and a stated policy of wage increases below productivity gains. So Germany introduced the wage reductions, the wage flexibility, precisely as the Bundesbankers had required. Now, the difficulty was what? Well, the difficulty was the failure of the rest of the EU to follow these policies, which has produced precisely the kind of political pressure for internal transfers that had already been foreseen in 1996 by the Bundesbankers. The problem was made even more difficult because of the weakness of countries to introduce these sorts of austerity measures now had to compete with the success of Germany in introducing them. So it's not only a question of reducing Greek wages or Italian wages. You have to reduce Greek and Italian wages by more than Germany had already introduced and reduced its wages. So if we look at the post-1999 policy, and this is, again, I'm quoting from Issing, the 11 countries that joined the euro were all heterogeneous. Now there are 19. Heterogeneity has increased. The obvious challenge was to continue with the convergence process. But there was no speed-up of convergence after 1999. Once you crossed the line and you got into the euro, what happened? Well, says Issing, nothing happened. Rather, the opposite happened. From day one, quite a number of countries started working in the wrong direction. Quite a few countries, including Ireland, Italy, and Greece, behaved as though they could still devalue their currencies. Of course there is a problem if wages rise by more than productivity. This is obvious, and this is precisely what was happening, so that the wage divergences were becoming larger rather than becoming smaller. The problem accumulated over time and only stopped because of the crisis. As long as member countries remain sovereign states, they need to abide by the Stability and Growth Pact. Okay? This is the basic argument. If we don't have political unification, we have to impose the pact. Germany and France violated the pact in 2003, delivering a fatal blow to the pact from which it has never recovered. Now, the European Council more or less ignores it. These political failures led to a crisis that was aggravated by the collapse of financial markets on a global scale. So again, it wasn't the international US-European linkage, it was an independent euro crisis, according to the Bundesbankers. Now, since Peter is here, I shouldn't do this and say the ECB is complicit, but according to the Bundesbanker, the ECB was complicit because this transfer process, in fact, occurred because the ECB introduced the policy, if you look at the second blip in his graph, which Issing calls the bailout. Okay. Given that there is no likelihood of political union in the near future, the monetary union with fiscal sovereignty of member states now can only continue if there is no bailout clause. The ECB can no longer intervene in order to support governments and government debts. Today, the no bailout clause is violated every day, de facto. I would not expect the ECB to say, from now on, nations must be compliant with the rules. But if the euro is going to survive, the direction should be towards agreeing and respecting those rules. Now, this one, we can skip this one. The result is what? And again, this is a direct quotation. Within the monetary union, the idea is one speed. My preference would have been that when it was obvious that its debt situation was unsustainable, and he's talking now about Greece, no more financial support would have been granted to Greece, and the country would have had to leave the euro. Okay? We all know that the finance minister, Schäuble, had made this proposal in the discussions with the Greek government. The Greek government unfortunately resisted at that stage, but the preferred solution, and according to the Bundesbanker, the solution required for the survival of the euro would have been the decision to force Greece to leave. After that, the EU would offer all the support it could to Greece to help its economy recover and ensure that it could rejoin the euro from a much stronger position. Okay? This is an important point because, as Issing notes, and a number of us had pointed out at the time, and I think now is generally recognized, what initially took place was that a bailout occurred that saved the banking system of France and Greece and indirectly France and Germany and indirectly Greece, and mainly stopped French and German banks from incurring losses in Greek bonds. Okay? The bailout funds, which could have been used in order to support the Greek economy and to make it a suitable entrant to the euro, instead went to pay off the Greek and the French banks and avoid losses. So Issing is saying we might have used that bailout money in a much better way if Greece had been forced to leave the euro. And it then could have avoided the kinds of failed readjustment that we currently are witnessing. It created a situation with all the wrong incentives. It would have been better to demonstrate a country could leave the euro and rejoin from a much stronger position later. And as I mentioned in the beginning, this is the proposal, the substitute for the lack of political integration that, or political unification, that is clearly in prospect. If we look at the political conditions across the EC member states, we find that there are, shall we call them, separatist movements in virtually all countries, political parties that are rising up and recommending that governments choose to leave. That is, the UK was the first, and there are very strong movements in a number of other countries in which this will be the case. So from the point of view of the Bundesbankers, their suggestion is that two speeds should be possible, but also re-entry should be possible. That is, expulsion is not permanent, and bailout funds, if they're used, should be used to provide economic convergence that will eventually allow the countries to rejoin. Thank you.